From Studio 22, you're listening to Servcast with your hosts William Lamb and Tyler Shores. Servcast is dedicated to challenging those who have a desire to serve, lead, and make the world a better place through the love of Jesus Christ. And now, here's William and Tyler.
And we are back in the studio, Servcast. I'm joined with your host, Dr. William Lamb.
Summer is over, Tyler, at least for our Lee University campus.
Yeah, as we're recording this today, we're getting ready for move-in and Deke Day. And if you're not sure about Deke Day, you need to go check out the very first episode that was almost 1 year ago.
We exactly, can you believe
you know
that?
What? The haters said we couldn't do it, but here we are, William.
I don't know who the haters are, but I am glad we are here.
If you're a hater, please don't talk to me. I don't know that I can handle that. So just tell me all the love.
Speaking of haters, go rate Servcast and tell us what you think about
it. You'll notice in our little tail-end thing, we're always like, if you like this episode, go rate and review. If you didn't like it, we don't want to hear what you have to say. So.
And today we have a really cool interview that I think is going to be impacting.
Man, oh man, I'm so excited for this interview, but we have an exciting event coming up, William, that we need to tell our listeners about. What's on the radar?
September 1, we have our second, which is we call Servcast Live, which means that we'll have a live studio audience when we're doing that particular episode. And our guest that night will be Dr. Terry Cross, which is the Dean of the School of Religion at Lee University.
Yeah.
So if you know Terry Cross, man, you're going to want to be in the room. If you don't know Terry Cross, trust us. You probably want to be here with us. Yeah. It's going to be 7 o'clock p.m. on the September 1st in the Dixon Center at Lee University campus. And if you're interested in about that, how can they find out?
Yeah, so if you will like the Leonard Center on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, we'll be sure to put out more information about how you can sign up and be there that night to catch this conversation, this live conversation with Dr. Cross. There'll also be a panel, and our beloved host, William, will be there.
Tyler, you're killing me.
So, I'm just excited to be back in the studio. That's all. So our conversation today, we have with us Dr. Sean Duncan, who is the director of the Lupton Center, which is an arm of Focus Community Strategies out of Atlanta. They're in South Atlanta. That was, you'll remember, William, the organization that was founded by Dr. Robert Lupton,
yes,
who is the author of books such as Toxic Charity and Charity Detox, which completely turned me up on my head. So we're really excited to have Dr. Duncan with us today to talk about, you can call him Sean because you're in the doctor club.
That's okay, man.
So I don't think he would really mind. He's a great guy.
No, actually, I don't think he would mind because this guy, has been there for a number of years, and just to hear his passion, but also to listen intently to the the development strategies that they are implementing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something that I think was really good as you got into this interview. Not all of their development strategies worked.
Right.
So if it's not working, man, bury that thing and find out what is working. And so I think you're going to enjoy these next 35, 36 minutes of listening to this episode with Sean Duncan and what's happening in Atlanta, which can be replicated in other places. And he'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and we're excited for that conversation. It's coming up next. We'll be right back with Dr. Sean Duncan. All right, and we're joined now by Dr. Sean Duncan.
Sean, welcome to Servcast. We're glad you're here with us, man.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity for the conversation today.
So now you're in Atlanta, and you represent an organization called Focus Community Strategies. Is that correct?
That is, yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about who you are and what Focus Community Strategies is all about.
Yeah, so my name is Sean Duncan, and I direct the Lupton Center here at FCS. And FCS is a community development organization that has been working in the city of Atlanta for about 40 years now. And our work is in partnering with neighborhoods to provide sustainable long-term development strategies where chronic poverty happens to be present. So I've been in relationship with FCS for a number of years now. I think it probably 5 or more years, but in this role directly for the last two.
So give us a biblical understanding of exactly what this organization is, and why are you doing this type of networking in communities? You know, I guess you're connected to a church, you're working with additional churches, or that kind of thing. Can you kind of speak to that for just a minute from a biblical perspective?
Yeah, so I think traditionally, as we look at Scripture, we point to really important passages of Scripture, like the Good Samaritan, or a passage about a cup of cold water, Matthew 25, what we do for the least of these. And these are deeply significant Scriptures that I'm glad that I hear more and more people talking about. These passages as being core to the gospel is not something that's kind of a secondary or tertiary concern for people who follow Jesus. However, I think what FCS has learned is we tend to over-rely on passages that address kind of the meeting of an immediate hurt that someone is feeling, and we don't pay as much attention to the broader biblical witness, where from beginning to end, Genesis to Revelation, there's a lot of work in there that has to do with systems and structures, whether that be the infrastructure of how a city is built, to the laws that are established to ensure that they are just and healthy, to the social network in which people live, and that we have an economy based on neighboring. So just there's a much more robust framework that we have seen throughout Scripture that says when we see poverty, specifically chronic poverty, the Bible has a lot to say about how cities are built, about how laws are constructed, about how society interacts with itself. And we have found that when it comes to chronic poverty, those are the things that are going to provide solutions. Those are things that we would call development approaches versus just a service model that notices, hey, you're hurting, and I want to respond to that condition. And in situations where there are crises that might occur, you know, flood, loss of a job, unexpected death in the family, these kind of things can be a disruptive crisis. And in situations like that, it makes perfect sense. Like the Good Samaritan story, that is an obvious crisis where someone's life is in danger, and just that immediate, generous, sacrificial gift is what restores and preserves life. But if the situation is more than a crisis, we have found that Scripture has a lot to say about just the structures in which we live and how we establish flourishing structures for our community.
So Sean, can you define for me this idea of chronic poverty? We know what crisis is, like you just mentioned. You know, a tragedy occurs, you know, some kind of situation happens. But what do you really mean when you say the word chronic poverty? What does that look like?
Yeah, that's going to be in how it is. Well, let me put it this way. The symptoms of chronic poverty might look similar in different contexts, but the system that is creating that symptom may be very different. So whether you're in a developing world country, or you are in an urban environment like we are, or you are in a rural environment in the United States, chronic poverty has to do with just ongoing lack of ability for sustainable well-being. Our objective at FCS is not just ensuring that people's needs are met. Like, part of our mission is shalom, or flourishing, holistic well-being, that we believe God intends for humankind to flourish. And so there are gaps in the system that is supposed to bring about flourishing. So chronic poverty is anything that is long-term and ongoing that an immediate service isn't going to solve. So, you know, if I provided you the bag of groceries today, but in 2 weeks you're still hungry, and I provide you with groceries, and then in 2 weeks you're hungry again, that's letting me know that there's a chronic situation that is pushing that symptom to the surface. That food insecurity is a chronic issue for your family. It's not a one-time crisis that you will bounce back from and be able to sustain for yourself. So if in an ongoing fashion, a family or an individual or a community, a neighborhood, find themselves unable to secure well-being, that's when we're saying this is chronic and it needs a development response rather than just a kind of an emergency service provider.
And for our listeners out there, I think that's a very important comment, because at the front end of this, you heard Sean talk about the fact that this organization that he's working with has a 40-year presence in Atlanta. And so, you know, when you talk about the idea that okay, this is, you know, chronic, well, you've seen a lot of those different factors that cause that, right? Can you identify a few of those for us, Sean? What are some factors that actually cause this thing we call chronic poverty?
Yeah, so in our context, which is going to be uniquely different than maybe some of our listeners, or maybe very similar, in an urban neighborhood in Atlanta, we're dealing with a lot of different interrelated things, which is part of what makes chronic poverty so complicated, is it is rarely the result of one thing. I mean, for example, you may have heard someone say, hey, the way to solve poverty is a job, or the way to solve poverty is a better education. And while we would say, man, absolutely, we can't see progress in our neighborhood without access to well-paying jobs or unless the schools improve. Like, we would agree with both of those wholeheartedly. What we would disagree with is the assumption that one thing is going to have significant impact. Because chronic poverty in our context has a lot of historical factors involved, and also has a lot of present barriers to flourishing that are involved. So being in Atlanta, race has had a lot to play with where you see poverty present in our society. The impact of housing policies, the impact of an economy that has, in a lot of ways, so the neighborhood we're in at one time was a thriving business district in an African-American neighborhood. And due to racially driven laws that changed the economy in this context, businesses left. And so without a healthy economy locally, you don't have access to sustainable jobs and sustainable wages. Those are just a lot of factors that kind of perpetuate what we're seeing and we're facing. Housing is a major piece of that. And so we find with lower income families, renting often is a way to kind of secure housing. But when you have rent that changes drastically without fair warning, you end up having families that are transient. And I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but the statistics of, you know, a third grader in a low-income school, just the sheer number of schools that student has been in by the time they're in third grade is just overwhelming. And that has a lot to do with housing. That's not because of parents making bad decisions or parents trying to somehow cheat the system or whatever, that this is about a lack of access to stable housing that's causing these kind of patterns. So, yeah, for us, there are just a whole host of interrelated factors that we're seeing that we got to say, you know, we can see food insecurity in this neighborhood, or we can see lower wages in this neighborhood, and providing a few extra services is not going to long-term disrupt that. We got to find longer-term strategies for that.
So in that holistic development kind of mindset, Sean, what are some of those strategies that you guys have found, you know, and maybe speak to how they're implemented, and perhaps, you know, what does it take to come alongside and do this type of long-term ministry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are, for FCF, we have three core pillars that drive what we do in our neighborhood. That is not to say that these three pillars address everything. We depend heavily on relationships. We believe that a holistic understanding of your context is really important. A holistic approach to addressing what's happening in your context is really important. But just because we have a holistic view doesn't mean that we feel responsible for everything involved in that holistic picture. So we depend heavily on building partnerships, working with other people, allowing others to do what they do really well, and allowing our organization to do what we do really well. So our focus, the three pieces that we focus on in our development strategy, one is neighborhood engagement. And so to your question about how do you come alongside, how do you begin, first of all, it's moving in. This is not work that can be done at a distance. Half of our staff live in the neighborhood. A good number of our board members live in the neighborhood. That deeply interpersonal, relational stuff is something that is hard to quantify, but it is vitally significant in this kind of work. That just like there's good charity and bad charity, there can be good development and bad development. And oftentimes bad development is when someone from the outside, without an in-depth understanding of what's taking place in a community, has a strategy or an idea of doing businesses or doing houses or doing streets or doing infrastructure, and they don't really have a sense of how that's going to impact the residents in the community. And so one of our major pillars in our work, one of the three, is just neighborhood engagement. And so that's just being good neighbors, that's being involved in the civic association, having street parties, just being involved in the fabric of neighborhood life, where people all over the world, whatever community they live in, they find ways just to engage their community and be a good neighbor. And that for us is not only first in order, but it's also first in importance. So mm-hmm. we start with that, but we also depend upon that heavily all the way through. A second pillar for us is mixed income housing. So I've mentioned the impact of a lack of sustainable housing and perpetuating chronic poverty. So for us, it is one of the most significant things we feel like we have to do is create a strategy for mixed income housing. So we don't do just affordable housing. Mixed income housing is very deliberate language. Affordable housing is deeply significant, but one of the ways that chronic poverty gets perpetuated is when we do affordable housing, we segregate it from everybody else's housing, which is part of the problem of chronic poverty. We not only segregate people often by race, but we segregate by socioeconomic class. And so if we simply isolate materially poor communities from the rest of the broader economy of that city, we perpetuate those issues. So even in providing affordable housing, the strategy for that can be detrimental to a community and to the people that experience it. So we do affordable housing in a broader strategy of also doing market rate housing, because we believe that the neighborhood will be strong if we have a mixed group of people of a variety of socioeconomic and racial backgrounds that are living together as neighbors. And so we have rentals, we have affordable mortgages, and we also have market rate homes. And what we don't do is put all the rentals on one block and all the market rate houses on one block and all the affordable mortgages on one block. We deliberately, every street in the neighborhood, we are deliberately trying to say, how do we create a neighborhood? Because it's not just about meeting material needs. It's about a relational context in which people live. And so having a very strategic, careful strategy for housing is essential. That this neighborhood has gone from 10% home ownership to well over 60% home ownership in our time here. And so as our city changes, we have homeowners who are not going to get pushed out by changing rent prices. Mm. And so this neighborhood becomes their neighborhood in a different way, because now they have property and a home that belongs to them. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty big part of what we have to do. And then the third main pillar of our work is an economic development. And so when we're doing economic development, that's more than just doing a jobs training program. It's actually providing actual local jobs. But more than that, it is putting healthy businesses in the neighborhood. As I mentioned, so historic South Atlanta is where we have been for the last 16 years. This once had a thriving business district, but has since lost that. And part of what we're seeking to do is restore healthy businesses. And what healthy businesses do in any healthy community is it creates neighborhood identity. It creates what you call third space, where people interact with one another. So the difference of people walking into our grocery store and interacting with each other versus someone walking into a food pantry to be handed a bag of food is just a radically different experience, because we need the customers and the customers need us to be there. Mm-hmm. Because this neighborhood has been a food desert for many years. And we're trying to find a way for a sustainable business for a small grocery store in a food desert. So starting businesses, not only just to provide jobs, but it does do that, but it also provides commerce. It provides neighborhood connectivity. It provides third space. It provides neighborhood identity. Everybody knows there are certain areas of the city based on what restaurant or store or park is there. And so we're trying to find ways to say, how do we do economic development along the housing and the neighborhood involvement as well?
This communal ownership, that I guess that's what you're talking about with regard to Dr. Lepton, you know, talks in his book about communal ownership and this whole idea of reciprocity. Man, it's refreshing almost to hear that, because I think that a lot of times what we're definitely seeing is we have this pockets, you know, and you can have, you know, on the same street four different types of pockets, but it looks like you're really blending that together. Is that what's kind of brought the success over the years for this thing, Sean? Is that idea of this communal relationships, is that, do you see that as a real success builder for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the pieces of success for FCS's journey has been being really honest about when our best intended strategies, even in development, aren't leading to the kind of results that we hope for, and finding ways to course correct and find a better way. So the model that we are working through now is not the model 20 years ago, and was definitely not the model 40 years ago. FCS for 40 years has been a very agile, adaptive organization, in that we've recognized that, man, we know that housing is essential for our chronically poor neighbors, but some strategies for that don't work. Like I mentioned, if we just isolate and compound all of the affordable units into one area, that's not a healthy strategy, right? So just being a learning organization has been one of the major keys, and also depending upon expertise beyond ourselves. Like I mentioned starting a grocery store. When our neighbors were talking to us about the need for a grocery store, we totally agreed that was a need for this area. We knew it was a food desert, but we also knew that on our team, we had like one guy who bagged groceries as a teenager. Like we were not set up to address something that major grocers don't want to do, and that's start a grocery store in a food desert. I mean, there's a reason they don't come.
Right.
And so bringing around us women and men of faith who have the marketplace skills to be able to create sustainable strategies for these deeply complex problems has been essential. Like, we may be as compassionate and ministry-driven as anybody in the world, but that does not mean we're going to be capable of cracking this really difficult nut. And so being willing to reach out to folks that can leverage their expertise in creative ways for this mission has been pretty essential.
I really like talking about, and I think you guys define it as Carver Market is the definition of this store.
Yeah.
I really like when we were doing some research on your organization, and you list it, you know, you talk about it being a small, intimate food market with the intention and the goal of connecting our neighbors back to food and then back to the community. So it really is kind of the whole idea, you know, where do you eat in the clock shop? Where do you go to school in the clock shop? You know, what do? You hang out at the clock shop. But the idea here is it really brings a cohesiveness. And can you speak for just a minute, Sean? We got some other questions, but I just kind of get this idea in my mind as I'm listening to you. Can you speak for just a minute about maybe some struggles that you've seen as you've tried to build this cohesiveness? And, you know, everybody wants to celebrate and talk about the good. What are some hard lessons that you did learn? You alluded to one a moment ago about, you know, we got to be willing to back up and say, hey, you know, this isn't going to work. We're going to stop that. But how does somebody who really feels like they're doing good, how do they endure this idea that, you know, man, I'm just keep hitting this wall, but I need to drill through that wall versus just ignoring that wall? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think part of what you have to build into your culture is measuring your impact and not just your activity.
Great.
So you can measure all day how many volunteer hours or how many programs or how many pounds of food, or even for us, you can measure how many houses that you've restored and made available. These are activity measures, and they have an important role to play, but they are not the ultimate. You got to learn how to measure impact, and then you have to learn to say, you got to have it, which is hard, you know, because in ministry we invest so much of our heart, we invest this sense that God has called us to do this, and so to admit that, you know, 5, 10, 20 years of hard work is not creating results is really hard for people, especially when they put God called us to this. It feels like our ministry. So we get all kinds of mixed, difficult emotions to process in that. But if we're willing to, so in our oath, if we're going to put the interest of those experiencing poverty above our own interest, or above the interest of our organization, we've got to be willing to admit whether or not we're having an impact. And if it's not the impact that we need to be having, how do we course correct? And so for us, you know, just I know you want to talk some about gentrification, and we'll do that. So that's one of the lessons we learned in a previous neighborhood, is that Atlanta then wasn't the city it is now, and people weren't moving in droves to live in the city. And so as we were doing some housing work, we were unaware that our strategy was promoting some of the negative versions of gentrification, which wasn't intended, wasn't expected. We were just unaware, and so we had to learn from that. We had to admit mistakes and adjust, and say we've got to have a different strategy, because this is not the kind of results that we can lead to. We can't create a strategy for the sake of those experiencing poverty that ends up hurting those experiencing poverty. I think from the beginning, I think it's a testament to the DNA that was in its organization when Bob founded it years and years ago, to the people that are still a part of it now, is just always a sense of like, man, we tried this. And it's, I mean, like when Bob wrote Toxic Charity and all the other books that he wrote that out of lived experience, where he's just confessing, well, I've tried to do it this way and it was really hurting people and I had to find a different way to do it.
Exactly.
So I think just having that, you know, just building a culture of that kind of honesty, I think, just allows you to be creative, and it allows you to listen to people differently. Like, if you don't hold that stuff so tightly, you can listen to your next-door neighbors, the community, the civic association, business leaders, city council people, just random strangers. You can just listen and discover. Because if your goal is to create flourishing in your context and not to build your brand or feel good about making a difference in the world, but if your goal is to see this flourishing happen, then you just got to be open and honest about those kind of things. And again, I think it's, you know, in my handful of years that I've been here, I've seen a culture, you know, among the top leaders in this organization of holding things lightly. I mean, they take it seriously and they invest heavily, but failure isn't something that terrifies people. I mean, they fail fast, they evaluate, they move on, they create a new strategy. And I think that's just it's a really healthy and unique thing to see.
I don't know if our listeners caught that, so I'm going to repeat what you just said. You know, take your calling seriously, but hold it lightly. You know, we don't own it. We just actually allow it to facilitate through us, right, as what God's doing in our own life. And, man, what a powerful statement. We got a few minutes left, so let's turn. And you mentioned the term just a moment ago about gentrification. So what does that mean? I mean, we're seeing that in a lot of urban cities, but what does it really mean? And how do you go about that process? And how is FCS actually doing this thing called gentrification?
Yeah, so that term, I mean, it, because of how cities are evolving and how that term is evolving, how it's used, we're more and more in a place of having caution just around the word in general, because I think what I'm witnessing is that word is being used to apply to a lot of different situations, and those situations are drastically different from one another.
Right.
And so what people often mean when they're using gentrification, they're talking about the displacement of long-term residents in lower-income areas.
Got it.
Which we would say, and hopefully anyone would say, is a wrong, unjust, unhealthy thing. That's the word gentrification, where development is being done in spite of and with no concern for low-income communities. As Bob was using the language gentrification with justice years and years ago when he was first using that phrase, that term wasn't nearly as loaded as now, because urbanization hadn't hit the pace and the volume that it has now. So we're now in an environment where urbanization is just happening so quickly, so rapidly, that displacement is occurring in a lot of communities. We're seeing it in Atlanta. And so part of what we're trying to do, maybe a different way to say it, is we're trying to promote justice in the midst of cities that are gentrifying rapidly.
Got it.
And so we recognize that a community like South Atlanta will, before long, and they're already starting, we're beginning to feel it just in the last year or two, but it won't be long before the effects of urbanization and gentrification really begin to impact what is happening here in South Atlanta. And so what we're doing is trying to do the work of justice and trying to do the work of development, so that when it happens, because it will be happening in this area, this is a neighborhood full of homeowners, and they won't be removed or dislocated, because they're not going to be at the whim of a renter who now is excited that he can charge double what he used to charge.
Sure.
And even those who do rent in this neighborhood, if they're renting from us, they know they're renting from someone who's not going to say, hey, you know, the city's changed. We can now double the rent overnight and no ill effects because it's totally legal to do it or whatever. You know, like we're not going to do that to our residents. And so it's just so part of our strategy. And it's, I mean, people would love a more simple answer to how do you solve this whole gentrification thing. One, you can't solve it because it's coming. I don't care what city. If you may be in a city where it's already happened, but if you're in a city where it hasn't happened yet, it's happening. It's going to happen in maybe 2 years or maybe 10 years, but it's going to happen. And if you want to prepare for that, it comes down to a housing strategy. It comes down to people being able to own their own homes in their community rather than renting, so that they can benefit from a market that changes rather than be kind of pushed out by it.
And that's the whole transformation process that you guys are talking about with this communal development, where mm-hmm. you know, people that otherwise would be displaced, you know, are being able to be established, so that instead of being generations of brokenness, you could have generations of wholeness down the road, which is a kind of, seems like that's the work of FCS, right?
Yeah, so I mean, and that's the thing, is like if you think about someone who in a you know, a different setting is getting pushed out one more time,
right?
Getting pushed down the road one more time, and what that means for their credit, what that means for their job, what that means for their kid's school. Though the effect of that kind of shift doesn't go away in 6 months, right? I mean, that affects the long-term health and stability of a family. It can affect the generational health of a family. Contrast that with someone who owns a home or is renting from someone who will care for them in just responsible ways. They're not moving. They're not being forced out. Or if they own their home and they choose to sell it, what are they doing? They are creating generational wealth for their
exactly.
family, because they own that asset, and that is sold for their own benefit, and they're choosing because if anyone moves, they want to move because they've chosen to,
mm-hmm.
And they've chosen a different path for their family that's going to benefit them in some way, whether it's schools or jobs or whatever. They're making that choice, not having that choice made for them. And again, the research has been done on people experiencing chronic poverty. Their brains look in the way that PTSD looks in a returning soldier from war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the daily trauma of the experience of poverty has long-lasting results in forming how brains even work. And so trying to find a more stable neighborhood in which someone can live, it decreases that sense of trauma, which can have those long-lasting, even generational effects.
Sean, I really appreciate the energy that you've given us to, you know, define this whole idea of holistic transformation and what does it look like. Now, you're leading the Lupton Center, which is actually a part of FCS. What is the Lupton Center? Who do you want to reach with it? What's its function? And what are you guys really doing with that?
Yeah, so the fourth part of FCS that's not directly related to development in this neighborhood is the Lupton Center. And the Lupton Center is our training and consulting division. So we have recognized that with a founder who's written a number of books, and with having a 40-year legacy in the work that we're doing, we have had a lot of phone calls and emails of people just saying, hey, we need help, we need training, we need consulting, we need something to help us kind of change our models and our paradigms. So 2 years ago, the board decided that we were going to found a division of this organization that exists for the sake of nonprofits and churches and other groups that are looking for new models. You've got to recognize this, especially if you're someone who is not currently or has not ever experienced chronic poverty, and the community that you seek to impact is not a community that you live in. There are already a dozen hurdles that are going to prevent you from having any clear understanding of what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first piece of all of this has got to be creating new conversations, creating new relationships, submitting oneself to the learning process of coming to understand what's really going on. And whether it's a small, dense urban neighborhood like we're in, or a very spread out rural community, or these sprawling suburban communities on the edges of our cities, regardless of where that context is, like, if we're not willing to do the hard work of just listening and learning, become a historian, become someone whose goal is to discover and love deeply the place in which you find. Love your neighbor, but also love your neighborhood. How do you develop that in-depth relationship? Because it's out of that that we begin to identify what the core issues are. Because we don't work with a neighborhood who has not invited us to come in and work with them. And even once we've received that invitation, we don't then drop our 10-year plan on top of them. We build a relationship, we receive the invitation, and even after the invitation is given, we craft a plan forward together. Because this is not, the vision for what should happen in this neighborhood doesn't belong to FCS, it belongs to the neighborhood. And so if you don't have that kind of relationship yet, that's got to be goal one. What most people want FCS to give them is the quick program to replace their previous program. But just that kind of program replacement strategy most often is not going to work. You've got to reframe the relationships before you can implement healthier strategies.
Good stuff. So how can our listeners learn more about you guys? Where can they find you? Yep. And, you know, what's ways that they can connect with you now in case they want to, say, come down and visit with you and get to see what's really happening there?
Yeah, so LuftonCenter.org is going to be the place where you kind of catch all the different things going on. We've got an online series called Seeking Shalom. We have open house coming up in October for people to come down and see what we're doing. But we also travel and do seminars and workshops in churches and with nonprofits around the country all year long. And so if you, because this is not a conversation that you can, this is not a paradigm you're going to shift on your own. You've got to create a very broad base of conversation around this. And so we love coming to churches and nonprofits and leading seminars and workshops and helping individuals who are convicted by these ideas to be able to bring along 20, 30, 200 people with them who are sharing in these experiences, sharing in these ideas so they can change that together. So whether it's online or coming here in person or bringing us out there with your church or nonprofit, we would love to come alongside you and support this transformational process. And you can learn all about those different resources on LuftonCenter.org.
Good deal. Sean, we really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today. We're championing what you guys are doing. You know, here at Lee University, we actually, talk about Dr. Lupton's book in class discussions and, you know, kind of unpack that theory and that idea. And it's refreshing to be able to hear real stories of where, you know, those theories actually are making long-term impacts, man. So thanks for joining us, and we hope to connect with you again soon.
Cool. Thanks for the time. It's good to talk to you guys.
All right. Blessings, Sean.
Right. And we'll be right back with some takeaways and challenges. And we're back following our conversation with Dr. Sean Duncan. Man, what a great conversation covering a variety of things, talking about new models and using the word paradigms a lot. That's always exciting.
And an accurate understanding of gentrification, right?
Yeah, it's massive. And I know, as Dr. Duncan mentioned, a lot of cities are facing it. So, you know, having a strategy for dealing with that is certainly important if you're in the development industry. But William, what are you taking away from this conversation?
There's a couple of key factors. One that I think is very, very important. You know, what he's talking about today is over a 40-year span of successful in-reach to communities. And I think better than just the idea that this has been 40 years, Sean hasn't been there that long, but yet it's kind of transformed him, and so therefore he's part of the transforming process. And I think that's a key element for us in understanding this whole idea of touching people's lives and community is that, you know, once that we're challenged, changed, it doesn't mean that we just kind of shelf our life at that point and say, hey man, I've arrived, it was really good. We actually turn around and start making investments. And Sean talked about this idea of holistic investment, not just you know, great definitions between the idea of chronic and crisis poverty, and what are the two of those look like? What are some factors that are creating this long-term chronic poverty kind of issue? But their approach is a holistic kind of a community transformation from corner to corner, and not just pockets.
Yeah, well, it's geographically specific to a particular neighborhood in South Atlanta. But a couple words come to my mind when I think about this conversation. The first one is presence. I mean, all of this happens because they have decided to move into this neighborhood and to not just...
And move in is the key.
Yeah, and move in. I mean, they're there. They are one of the people. They are as impacted by the changes that happen there as anyone else, because now that they're there, they're present, Like, they have a vested interest in what goes on. And the second word that comes to mind when I think about this conversation, also the books and the work that FCS is doing, is legacy. I mean, you and I have read through Talk to Charity. We've read other of Dr. Robert Lutton's books. And if you read the books or, like, go to a seminar where he's speaking, I mean, he's very honest. Like, and as even Sean mentioned, like, it's almost a confession of these are the things that we've learned don't work. Mm-hmm. So here mm-hmm. are the principles in place there. And this organization is what it is today, not just impacting that particular community, but equipping other organizations because of the long legacy of Dr. Lupton. So
I've done this for a long time in the sense of touching people's lives and caring for people and helping people. But Sean made a statement, and I want to quote this statement. He said, it's as important about measuring your impact as it is about your activity. Don't just measure the activity that we do in specifically, okay, we had this X number of pounds of food that we collected and redistributed. That's important. That's valuable. And we do that every day here, as you know. But he also talked about the reality of measuring your impact. What's working? What's not working? Mm-hmm. And how do we fix the thing that's not being effective? You and I use this term often here, you know, a stop doing list. What's right. something that I can stop yeah. doing because it's either not working or it's draining us or whatever the case may be. So I was really challenged personally by the reminder that measuring my impact is very important, and I can't let that just kind of slide off into the sunset somewhere.
Well, you think about the conversations we have with students. So we work with student leaders who are basically running many nonprofits mm-hmm. around different causes. We commonly refer to them as the service council. But, I mean, we talk to them about outputs versus outcomes. What are those numbers that talk about your activities, so number of kids mentored or pounds of food or whatever? But then you got to look at all those numbers and say, so what? Mm-hmm. And then that's where you get your outcomes, and that's how you measure your impact. I mean, at the end of the day, if we're moving things around or just accumulating numbers, but we're not making the difference that we want to make, then, you know, we need to reevaluate.
So. And I think one of the key points that, as we close this episode today or this segment today, one of the key points that I think is very, very important is that because they're measuring impact and not just the idea of the activity, they can have a transformational presence for 40 years.
Right.
I wonder how many times these organizations that many of us have been part of and some of us have started that were not sustained. Now, there's a lot of reasons why an organization may not have been sustained, but I have to believe, having some experience with that myself, is that the key factor is, am I there just to measure the activity or am I there to measure the impact and then participate in the transformation? Seems like to me that's real gospel, New Testament principle stuff, Mr. Theologian, right?
Yeah, well, one thing I appreciated him talking about was how the Bible is very concerned with structures. So, I mean, we can't, as in my opinion, as church people, just sit over in our churches and not participate in the way that our cities and our communities are organized. Like, we need to be involved. And you're going to use that P word, man. You got to get into the politics of it. Like, you got to be there. And he said, so he talked about that, which I appreciated as a student of ethics. But then also the comment he made was, love your neighbor, love your neighborhood. Mm. So we have to be as concerned with the environments that our neighbors and ourselves are living mm-hmm. in if we're going to see people move out of this generational chronic poverty situation.
So we really want to encourage people, take time, check it out. LuptonCenter.org, I think he said.
Yeah, the LuptonCenter.org. I've been to their open house.
Yeah.
It is fantastic. I came back with just so many ideas, and it's left a mark on me in the way I think about this. So I highly recommend that. I know they have an online course that Dr. Duncan mentioned, Seeking Shalom, I believe mm-hmm. it's called. But as you mentioned, we'll link all those into the show notes. So please check it out. Get connected with this organization. They're really doing some great stuff, and they really care about passing it on to other people. So.
And as always, we're thankful that you're listening to Servcast today. We have a couple of things coming up that are very important. September 1, we have what's called Servcast Live, if you're at the Lee University campus and you want to participate in that event. But we've got a show coming up soon that, Tyler, it's going to be you, man. We're going to talk about you. And so we won't do that now, but hey, you want to stay tuned to Servcast. And hey, as always, guys, thank you for listening. And remember, you're made for more. Make an impact for the long haul.
Thank you. thanks so much for listening today to ServeCast. We're glad you joined us for this conversation with Dr. Sean Duncan, who is the director of the Lupton Center. If you like this episode, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. And if you have a question, we will put it to William on air. You got to ask it. You can ask that by emailing us at servecast22. That's servecast22@gmail.com. We'll talk to you next time on ServeCast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ServeCast. The thoughts and opinions expressed on ServeCast are those of William Lamb, Tyler Shores, their guest, and no one else. Until next time, this is ServeCast, signing off from Studio 22.